This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. It was a photograph titled Lesbian Couple at Le Monocle that inspired Francine Prose's latest novel. Two women are seated at a table. One is in a dress, the other in a tuxedo. The suited woman pictured is Violette Morris. She was a French race car driver who became a Nazi collaborator. Oh, there's more. Prose's latest novel is called Lovers at the Chameleon Club, Paris, 1932. It imagines Morris's life through multiple narrators of varying reliability. Francine Prose joins us now. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Tell us what drew you to this photograph.
Well, it's a very beautiful and a very strange photograph. I'd known it for a long time, but it wasn't until about 1999, 2000, I saw it in a show at the National Gallery in Washington, and there was a little wall text that said that the woman in the tuxedo had gone to work for the Gestapo during the Nazi occupation of Paris. And I thought, really? So I went home and did a little research, and sure enough, some of what you just said, she was an athlete, she was an auto racer, and when the French government took away her license to compete professionally because cross-dressing was in violation of the Napoleonic Code, Hitler found out about it and invited her to be his special guest at the 36th Berlin Olympics. I mean, ignoring his distaste for homosexuality and realizing that she had contacts with these regional sports associations all over France. So sure enough, she became a spy. She went back to France, and she was the one who told the Germans where the Maginot Line ended so they could invade in 1940, and went to work for the Gestapo and was assassinated by the French resistance in 1944.
Went to work as and gained a reputation as a torturer,
mm-hmm.
a fierce
the
torturer.
Hyena of the Gestapo, in fact.
Wow.
She was called.
So this is an incredible story all by itself. When did you decide to write? I mean, the biography would have been just fine.
I
but
know.
No, you
I
write
know.
A novel.
Well, it was around the time my then French editor told me how much research she thought I was going to have to do in the Bibliothèque Nationale. You know, I thought, I don't really want to. But it was so much more fun to do it this way because, you know, it's one thing to write about the Berlin Olympics. Very interesting.
Yeah.
Another thing to write about it from the point of view of a furious former athlete, French patriot, intense race car driver who suddenly, after feeling like her life has come to nothing, is treated like a star in Berlin and meets Hitler at a dinner party.
Yeah, and the novel warns us not to over-psychologize, and yet it's beautiful inquiry into questions of identity and loyalty. All of it is handled quite beautifully and adroitly. Can I ask you to read for us?
Yeah, sure. This is the very beginning of the novel. The novel's written in several voices. There are about six or seven major narrators, and one of the narrators is a character named Gabor, who's a photographer, and he's based loosely on the great Hungarian-French photographer Brassai, who took the photo of the lesbian couple in Le Monocle. So Brassai himself was writing letters back home to his parents in Hungary all the time he was in Paris. So I thought, well, I would just write my own. So this is how it begins. Paris, May 14th, 1924. Dear parents, last night I visited a club in Montparnasse where the men dress as women and the women as men. Papa would have loved it. And Mama's face would have crinkled in that special smile she has for Papa's passion for everything French. The place is called the Chameleon Club. It's a few steps down from the street. You need a password to get in. The password is, police, open up. The customers find it amusing. A bar, a stage, a dance floor, leather banquettes, tables around the edges. A typical Paris nightclub, except for the clientele. But here's the most surprising thing. The owner is Hungarian. She calls herself Yvonne. She's tall and blonde and dresses in red and has a weakness for sailors. She sings in that husky voice Papa adores, subdued and choked with tears. When she sang, I heard Papa's phonograph muffled and locked in his study. Yvonne's song was about a woman whose sailor boyfriend has drowned at sea. I'd never heard a sadder song, not even from the gypsies. Yvonne sang with her eyes closed, one hand raking her hair. In her other hand, pressed to her forehead, she held an unlit cigarette. I felt clammy and chilled to the bone, though the club was smoky and hot. I reached for my camera the way as a boy I used to reach for your hands, but I'd left it in my room. I was hoping to make a few friends before I asked to take pictures of bankers and diplomats whose wives might not know that their husbands go out dancing in high heels and dresses. Even after a year in Paris, it took some getting used to. The hardest part was not staring. Or was I supposed to stare? Photographing these birds of paradise will be a challenge, don't you think?
Francine Prose, reading from her latest novel, Lovers at the Chameleon Club, Paris, 1932. She's going to be at the Regulator Bookshop tonight in Durham and Malaprop's Bookstore in Asheville tomorrow, as a matter of fact. So this is the photographer, Gabor, who you have other narrators. Tell us about them.
Well, there is Gabor. There's a character named Lionel Mayne who's very loosely based on Henry Miller. So he's writing a kind of Henry Miller novel, expatriate Paris, wine, women, song, love, sex, blah, blah, all the way through the book. And he was kind of the most fun to write. I mean, the easiest, certainly, because, you know, he's such a blowhard. It was like, it was effortless. And then there's a baroness who's an art collector. She's married to a manufacturer of luxury automobiles and race cars, and she's a patron of Gabor's art. She buys his art and photography, and she's also the one who sets up the character whose real name was Villette Morris, who I call Lou Villar, as a race car driver. So all these characters are kind of interconnected, whether they want to be or not. Then there's a woman named Suzanne, who's Gabor's girlfriend, who becomes a French resistance heroine. And there's a third-person part about Yvonne, who runs the Chameleon Club. And then the most complicated part, the hardest part, is Lou's own story is told. It's told as a kind of bogus biography that I wrote, a sort of fake French biography, by a woman named Nathalie Dunois, who's a French high school teacher, extremely neurotic. And as the story gets darker and darker, she can't stop talking about herself. So it gave me a way to leaven some of the darkness of that last part of the novel with humor, really.
But also, I think that's part of the thread of caution that goes through this, that any kind of facile or reductivist analysis of who these characters are or why one might turn from a repressed childhood to turning on your nation, I mean, that's kind of an easy answer. But the novel doesn't give us those because we have to question certainly the narrators and their own motives and their own filter.
And what they say. Everybody has a different version of what happened. The way, you know, I'm sure if you ask any cop, you know, 10 witnesses and you'll get 10 different stories of what happened, the crime. Well, it's the same way. I mean, this huge crime happened, the occupation of Paris. And you get these different characters who all see it this different ways. Plus, there's several love triangles in the novel. And the minute you get a love triangle, you get automatically three very different versions of who thinks what, feels what about whom.
Well, and also very different versions of love and affection, right? And so all of those questions that you thought you had answered because you understood what this is turn out to be even questionable in your own mind.
Yeah.
So, well, can I ask you to read for us again?
Sure. So this is the first page of the biography, quote unquote, that I mentioned. And the biography is called The Devil Drives. So this is the first page of Nathalie's biography of Lou Villar. From The Devil Drives, The Life of Lou Villar by Nathalie Dunois, author's preface, The Mystery of Evil. I first heard the name of Louisiane Villar whispered when I was a girl visiting my great-aunt Suzanne Dunois, the wife and later the widow of the photographer Gabor Tsenyi. I remember hearing Lou's name and feeling a chill, as if the winter wind had blown open the door of my great-aunt's enviable Paris apartment, an old-fashioned artist studio with whitewashed walls, leaded windows, and a collection of modernist chairs that guests, especially children, were forbidden to sit on. For many years, all I knew was that Lou Villar was the woman in a man's tuxedo in Gabor Tsenyi's photograph, Lovers at the Chameleon Club, Paris, 1932. Doubtless my readers are familiar with the portrait of the lesbian couple, the pretty girl in the sparkly gown sitting beside her broad-shouldered lover with pomaded hair and a man's pinky ring on her finger. Both stare into the middle distance with unfocused expressions, unreadable, or so I thought, until I began my labors on this book. I'd never understood why Lou Villar's name had so lowered the temperature in the room until I attended the 1998 show of Tsenyi's work at the Centre Pompidou, to which I had traveled from Rouen, where I had been living and teaching for almost 20 years. The wall text for Lovers at the Chameleon Club explained that the woman in the tuxedo was a French auto racer named Louisiane Villar, who later spied for the Germans and collaborated with the Nazis. I shivered, just as I used to, in my great-aunt's apartment. The chill lowered my defenses, and I caught a fever to understand, and so was planted the mutant seed that has grown into the devil's drives, my message in a bottle.
Francine Prose, reading from Lovers at the Chameleon Club, Paris, 1932. Were you about to? I didn't know if you were going to follow up with that, because one of the issues, one of the themes that's raised in that passage is the question of the gaze, these voyeurs. You have a novelist who's trying to sort of reflect life in his own way, the photographer, and then the biographer. All of them have this now permission to gaze at this unusual sight in their midst.
Yeah, and again, I mean, it depends. Are you taking a photograph? Are you trying to understand what's going to happen? How are you looking? What is your own relation to the thing you're looking at? No, the thing I was going to follow up saying is that the writing in that passage, and in fact the writing in the biography, varies from quite good to not so good. And it was a huge pleasure to write badly on purpose. So you know, I caught a fever to understand. Believe me, that is not me. So I became right. Some other character.
Well, when did this idea occur to you that the way to tell the story would be through multiple voices, multiple narrators?
All I knew at the beginning was that I had two characters, the photographer and the subject. That's all I knew. And then I began to realize that there were parts of the story that neither of them would know. I mean, they certainly wouldn't know each other's story. And then there were huge missing chunks of the story that only someone else would know. So it kind of began, it was like piecing together pieces of a puzzle. Who wouldn't know that missing piece? And then the narrative just kept expanding. I mean, I thought I would just keep it to maybe the occupation or something. Suddenly I was, you know, I thought if I'm going to write about Paris when it got so dark, I have to write about it when it was bright and lively and glorious and full of artists and writers. So suddenly... Suddenly I had 20 years that I had to cover.
But as you said, you were trying to avoid hours in the bibliothèque. So did you make all that up to – I mean, how much of that do you feel research?
I kind of lost – I mean, the embarrassing thing is that I kind of lost track of what was true and what wasn't. Yeah. I mean, I just wanted – I did a lot of research. I did a lot of reading. And some of it was very specifically focused on these characters and these events, the Berlin Olympics, Paris Between the Wars. But then I also – read a lot of more theoretical history about the rise of fascism and what people thought turned people into fascists and so forth. So I really wanted to understand this time these characters and the larger issues that they were dealing with.
You, I'm always curious about this because I think you've done an amazing job keeping these voices distinct. As you say, it's very clear when this sort of turns into purple prose, and it does evolve even in a single passage. Each voice is distinct. Do they start out that way, or do you have to kind of go back, you know, midway through the writing to go back and say, oh, I hear that voice a little differently now?
Well, I'm just glad you think so. I mean, it was my major worry because, you know, when I'm writing, I write for rhythm, for cadence as much as anything else. And if I have what seems to me an off cadence or an awkward sentence, then I feel the compulsion to go back and change it till it's melodious, really. But I couldn't do that with all these characters because they couldn't all sound – because, in fact, if I were to start to read to you from all the different voices, you might think just because I'm reading it that they were the same voice because it's my own cadence. But, in fact – I had to work pretty hard to get them distinguishable one from the other.
It's tough if you've got a character with a kind of a tin ear, so they don't speak, you know, well.
Yeah. Well, the Henry Miller character, again, that was no problem. Nobody else sounds like him. Nobody else would sound like him. So that was a piece of cake.
When you, as I say, you're sort of warned against kind of a reductive analysis of how a character might get this way. But I couldn't stop thinking about it, how someone, you know, you go to these clubs ostensibly to express yourself. There's a repressed society outside, but we have these oases in which we can dress the way we want. And you can't help but get the feeling in this book that we're not who we are, not even in this club, but who we've become because of the pressures from outside. And I think that's well represented in the book. So do you have, you know, sort of ideas about how you can become the oppressor so easily?
Well, I think that what happened, and certainly what happens to my character, is that all you need is a sense of resentment. I mean, the fact that the Germans were told that they'd been stabbed in the back by the Versailles Peace Treaty. You have this widespread sense of resentment, and you add to that privation and suffering and hunger. Not enough food, not enough money, the devaluation of the mark, the rioting and for political rioting in France. And then you just put a demagogue on top of that. And it's this volatile mixture. And it's like, you know, throwing a match into a can of gasoline, boom. And that's what happens on the larger scale. And that's what happened to my characters. My character, she, all she wants to do is dress as a guy, play sports, and be loved. And one by one, those things are denied her and taken away from her. And she feels that she's a French patriot, that she wants to save France. And the Germans convince her that all those things she wants, she can have back, and that they're going to take France and purify it and give it back to her. So she's an ideal candidate for what happened.
But it also speaks to the political genius of being able to put us in a binary, a gender mm-hmm. binary, lock us into a moral code that is somehow related to this invention of ours, and then have the genius to play on that resentment and turn that into political power after you're the one who created the problem.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And also to be aware of how mass groups feel and how individuals feel. I watched both the Leni Riefenstahl films, or the two, early, you know, Triumph of the Will and the ultra boring Olympic film during when I was making this. And I was just amazed at the choreography, the forethought, the ability to stir up emotion and passion that was going, you know, the Nuremberg rally. It's very hard to watch because everybody's so beautiful and enchanting. And you know, of course, you're remembering all the time the unbelievable evil that was done in the name of this. But on the other hand, aesthetically, it's wildly attractive.
Francine, wonderful book. Thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Thank you.
Francine Prose is the author of Lovers at the Chameleon Club, Paris, 1932. She will read tonight at the Regulator Bookshop in Durham, tomorrow Malaprop's Bookstore in Asheville. That's at 7 o'clock tomorrow. And that's our program for today. Thank you for listening. If you missed that, go to our website. You can find it again, stateofthings.org. Lots of information there. You will also learn that our program is produced by Laura Lee, Nicole Campbell, Megan Modafferi, and Anita Rao. You'll find out that Robin Copley is our technical director. More than that, you'll see that Brent Wolf is our news director. And if you didn't know that, you'll find out also that North Carolina Public Radio is the grand producer of this program, and that's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.